Accession number 8256, reel number 1.
Mr. Osborne, reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Osborne?
I was born in Warwick.
Which year was that?
1924.
And what did your father do for a living?
Father was in the army. Originally, he was a schoolmaster, and he joined the army, the Royal Lancaster Regiment, as a schoolmaster at the dizzy rank of corporal.
And where were you educated?
In Warwick, Westgate School, Warwick.
What kind of a school was that?
It was the ordinary county secondary modern school.
So how old were you when you left?
14 and a half.
To do what?
I did a bit of gardening before I joined the Royal Navy in October 1939.
How old would you have been then?
15.
Which places did you do your early training in?
St. George on the Isle of Man.
And how did you come to join the Prince of Wales?
Well, I left training ship in October, and I went October 1940, and I went down to Plymouth to await a ship. Classmates went to various ships, some to one of the ships I would like to have gone on, one of the tribals, but I was shipped off to Rosyth to join the Prince of Wales in March. Yes, it would be February 1941.
Why did you want to join a tribal?
Well, you know, as a boy seaman, I know myself as a boy seaman, I used to know the majority of the ships in the service at that time. I could name all the V&Ws, the A's, right through to the J's, K's, the L's. We knew what happened to them. And the tribals were the sort of elite of the destroyer force. They weren't the real workhorses as we know them. And to someone like myself, they were, I suppose, the fighters of the Navy, rather as a fighter plane is the fighter of the Royal Air Force. The destroyer, particularly the tribal, was the fighter of the Royal Navy.
So what were your reactions on being posted to the Prince of Wales?
Well, I'd been hanging around Plymouth for 2 or 3 months, and I think any ship would have done at that time, because I was anxious to get away to sea. I remember juggling my courses in training because I saw a loophole, and I deliberately dipped examinations so that I would be moved, channeled to another class, and I knew I could get to sea a month sooner by doing this. And it was obvious what I'd done. I had to see the commander, and he knew what I'd done, but he just let it go through. I'd failed the examinations, and I was shipped off eventually down to Plymouth.
Why were you so keen to go to sea?
Oh, boys, you know, I wanted to join the Royal Air Force originally, and then as a tiny tot, must have been when I was 7 or 8 years old, then the Fleet Air Arm took over from the Royal Air Force. Then I saw the opportunity of getting into the Navy and transferring to the Fleet Air Arm at a later stage. But I was taken prisoner before I was able to transfer to the Fleet Air Arm.
What type of reputation did the Prince of Wales have in the Navy?
In the Navy, or I'm not sure, because I didn't come into contact very much with people outside the Prince of Wales. But on the Prince of Wales, she was a much loved ship. She was a happy ship. The captain, I think, was, well, my idea of the perfect naval officer. He was And shall I put it this way? A gentleman first and an officer second. People say an officer and a gentleman, but as far as I'm concerned, Leach was a gentleman and an officer.
In what way was he a gentleman?
He seemed to have a consideration for the ship's company. Little things. Going on to November 1941, a simple thing. My brother got out to Colombo about 2 or 3 weeks before I did. And we arrived in Colombo and he came aboard. He'd been serving in North Africa at the time and went out to the Far East. And I arranged to see him the following day. And as a boy seaman, I had to be back on board at 6 o'clock. So I asked for an extension of leave. Gave the reason. And I went to see the captain the following morning for permission to for an extension of leave. And before I saw the captain, the divisional officer said that your request is a washout. I'll alter it for you. And I didn't know what my request said. And the captain just looked at this request and said, request granted, go forward, get changed, there'll be a boat alongside waiting for you. And he let me go ashore knowing that the ship would be sailing shortly after noon. And he let me go ashore that morning about 8 or 9 o'clock. Well, it would be 9 o'clockish. And the transport up to the Echelon barracks to see my brother. I saw him for about 2 hours and we went on to Singapore and he went up into Burma. Just that our paths crossed. But it's an idea of the thought of the captain. Another thing is that where some ships would take up Saturday and Sunday with rounds and divisions and church parades, he would condense this into one day, Saturday, leaving Sunday free apart from the church parades. So this is a thoughtful man.
When you first arrived at Rosyth and went aboard Prince of Wales, can you give me an impression of the impression it made on you?
Yes, we went by train from Plymouth up to Rosyth, into Rosyth Dockyard, and we lined up on the side of the dock. She was in dry dock at that time, and one could only see a certain amount. She seemed rather low to me, but then these huge upper works. She looked solid. She had lovely lines, better lines than I had thought. I knew the King George V had been commissioned. I knew the Prince of Wales was on stocks, and to me they were just uninteresting battleships were. But the Prince of Wales seemed to have something to her. It's rather strange that there is no association, ex-service association for the Prince of Wales. There are no reunions, and yet I believe that if you were to ask any of the people who served on her, they were happy on board.
Can you think of any reason why there shouldn't be a Veterans Association for the Prince of Wales?
I think we're all sad about her in one way. She was a happy ship, and yet she wasn't unlucky. People say she was a Jonah. Well, this is just a way of expressing something, but to me she was not a Jonah. As I say, she was a home. She was a very good home to, 1,500 men. There may be the odd one, of course, who perhaps has a grudge, complaint, but that is their own fault. Do you know, when the captain was injured during the Bismarck action, he went down to London Hospital and so on. And we thought that he was not coming back, that he would be replaced. How the rumour started, I don't know. You know, on the lower deck you get all sorts of rumours, perhaps in the wardroom as well. But how they start, I don't know. But we thought the captain was not coming back. Then we heard that the captain was coming back at a given time on a certain day, or that particular day, and it was virtually clear lower deck. The whole ship's company were on the upper deck to greet him. Now, the Master at Arms was there, of course, and it's only hearsay, but I understand the captain had to say something to the Master at Arms, because it was not done in the Navy to have people clearing lower deck to receive their captain in a natural, voluntary way.
So this indicates his popularity?
Oh yes, yes.
Now, what was the first action you were involved in on board the Prince of Wales?
Oh, the Bismarck was the first action. There was the odd shot fired at aircraft or that sort of thing, but I remember in Rosyth we had some anti-aircraft fire, but it was not the not even the 5.25s. It was only the close range.
Can you describe the Bismarck action in as much detail as you can recollect, as far as it affected you personally?
Yes, I'm not sure of the date that we left Rosyth. I can remember being under, I think, 2 hours sailing orders. And it was probably about the 21st of May, I'm not sure, not having kept a diary. We sailed north, the weather got foul, and it was just an ordinary trip at sea. We knew that we were going to try and intercept a ship. Most of the time we sailed along in company with the Hood. We sailed on her starboard quarter. In fact, I used to watch her for, fascinated for hours on end, and I stood on the port side of the Prince of Wales just outside the screen door forward of P3 turret. P3 turret is a 525 turret. There are four on each side of the ship. P1 turret, not P3. They went P1, 2, 3, 4 aft. I stood there and remember one evening had the evening watch off, and the sea creamed over her bow and ran down her side. And if you know the Hood, she had a sort of high centre amidships where the water seemed to roll along, and the quarterdeck to me seemed to have an exaggerated tilt forward. And the water then creamed round up between the after superstructure and the turret, just foaming across. And as I say, I was quite fascinated listening, watching this and listening to the sea. I was fascinated by the sea, particularly heavy seas. It was so impressive. And we made our way up to the Denmark Straits. Literally, I can remember nothing from then until the night before we met the Bismarck. We left our turret and went below. We had a bath, clean underclothes, in case of wounds and so on. My impression of wounds in those days before the action was one got a slight nick in the shoulder and got up saying, "I'm all right." But it was not so. Then, of course, we went back to the turret, spent the night in the turret, torn action stations. And I remember the padre saying a few words, prayer. Rather strange, that coming over the loudspeakers. And something that impressed me more than anything else was we flew the White Ensign aft from the mainmast aft, and having the battle ensigns at the mainmast, the big mast forward, was it's like playing Land of Hope and Glory, you know, you get chills running up and down your spine when you see this lovely white ensign, because it is a beautiful flag. And seeing that going up is quite remarkable. Then, of course, we didn't know much. I was in as an S2 turret, the working space of S2 turret, which was on the catapult deck, corner of the catapult deck. S2 was a 525 turret. Again, as I said, we had P1234 on the port side, S1234 on the starboard side. We fired rounds at this, that. I'm not really sure what we fired at because we didn't see. And the sight setter suddenly shouted out, "The hood's gone." And someone said, "What?" And he said, "The hood's gone." And it was just unbelievable that the hood was there 1 minute and she was no longer there. It's difficult after all these years to say, one, I have to be careful not to draw on information I've read. But I seem to remember it being no time at all. No time at all. Anyway, we carried on firing. The 14-inch guns fired. They were not firing very well. Some were breaking, guns were breaking down, and as you probably know, we had people from the dockyard, civilians from the dockyard still on board. We sailed with them. The guns weren't working properly. Some of them, the after turret, we had a lot of problems with. But I really can't comment on that because this is knowledge. This isn't personal knowledge. It's what I know happened from being on the ship and talking to people. But what I do know is that we, being in seaman turret on the corner of the catapult deck, one was drawn on for all sorts of odd jobs. And for some reason, we were pulled out of the working space and had to go up onto the boat deck. Shortly after, we'd had a shell come inboard and on the boat deck. Can't remember why we were up there. I remember seeing the engineer commander up there, and the noise. One can almost feel it now, the noise of a ship under full power. Those big intakes sucking in air, the exhaust going, all contributing to the immense power within a ship like the Prince of Wales. And I was at the after end of the boat deck, towards the starboard side, with perhaps half a dozen more. The engineer commander was there. And there was a blast, shock, and sort of stumbled across the deck. And I thought of shells coming inboard, not knowing very much about sea actions. But it wasn't. It was the after turret, trained as far on the bow as she could. And when the after turret was trained right on the bow, the muzzles of the guns almost came up alongside the after end of the boat deck. And you can appreciate that those guns firing and being not very far away from them was quite a blast. In fact, I remember that the Prince of Wales had two cutters on the forecastle. They were stowed up towards the screen, and the davits were shipped when they were needed to be used. And the first time we fired the 14-inch guns in the salvo in practice, they shattered the starboard cutter, which gives you an indication of the vibration, the power that is there. crockery breaks, of course, if it's not stirred properly. Lots of things fall all over the place. However, when shortly after that, I scuttled back to the comparative safety of the turret. And it's rather strange, one shelters behind a couple of inches of armoured plating, thinking one's safe. But as you well know, that 15-inch shell doesn't even blink at a couple of inches of armour plating. Well, we turned away, we went under smoke, and again, the bridge was hit, as you probably know, and I don't know whether other turrets were involved, but again, S2 turret was... Some of us had to go up to the bridge to clear up the bridge. We'd had a 15-inch shell go through the bridge and exploded as it was going out and killed an awful lot up there. And, as I said before, a boy of 16 thinks that being wounded is a nick in the shoulder. But I, in my keenness, I was very, very keen in those days. Went to do what I was supposed to do and start tidying up the bridge, and I went in and expecting to see people, and the first thing I saw as I went in, the wood panelling was just little bits of flesh spattered all around, and I turned around and came out, and quite unseeing, I think, because I'd learnt to smoke. It took me a long while to learn to smoke, to be one of the big boys. And I turned to someone, took a cigarette out and turned to someone and asked them to give me a light, and all I could see was gold braid all the way up his arm. He did give me a light and didn't say anything. He was very kind by not saying, "Get back in there," or something like that. And that was a very, very big shock to me. It made me appreciate that war was not fun. I don't think I ever got over that. Well, I think we're short of oil. I know the Prince of Wales could probably do 10 or 12,000 miles at economical steam engine. You'd probably do about 2,500, 3,000 under pressure. And we had been steaming very far, so it ties in with what I would think 3 to 4 days going up, and the 24th. That was Empire Day, by the way. I don't know whether you remember Empire Day.
Yes.
And I think perhaps that's why we were detached and went back to Iceland to patch up. We went into Reykjavik Fjord there. We had cruiser tied one side, 2 or 3 destroyers t'other. I think one of the destroyers was Echo. And it was a beautiful day after all that bad weather. Going back a bit, coming down from Iceland to from the Denmark Straits to Reykjavik, the weather was very, very bad, and after the ship had been closed up for some, I don't know, 2 days, but certainly for 24 hours, the water gets in from the heavy weather, the movement of the ship. The toilets are put out of action, but stuff comes back in somehow, and the smells around the ships, quite revolting. I seem to remember it as quite revolting anyway when I went back down below, some perhaps later on the 24th or 25th of May. I don't really remember when.
When you did the clearing up on the bridge after the shell went through it, what did the clearing up involve?
Initially it involved getting the bodies and the pieces of bodies together and wrapping them up and having them taken down below.
Swabbing down and that type of thing?
That's right. Clearing all the rubbish away. an awful lot of panelling there as well.
Just tearing down loose panelling?
Well, initially, as I say, it was clearing the personnel from the bridge, and then, as you say, swabbing down, but I think I avoided the clearing personnel from the bridge. Perhaps I'm more sensitive than most people.
What were your actual duties aboard ship?
I was in the seaman branch, and gunnery was my main area. But I think I don't, or rather I didn't know at the time, but after the Prince of Wales, sometime after the Prince of Wales was sunk, I was always being given extra duties on the Prince of Wales, and I think I was being schooled. When I was in training, I had something that perhaps isn't very often seen, that is a rating of superior. And when I was on the Prince of Wales, at first I thought I was being picked on. I had lots of extra duties when being in, as I say, one of the turrets on the corner of the catapult deck, one had the aircraft handling to do. That was part of the turret's duties, aircraft handling. And we were at sea once, and when we picked up an aeroplane, one of these supermarine walruses, we didn't stop for them. The ship slewed its stern around, smoothed the water, and the seaplane just sort of sat in that temporarily quiet water and taxied alongside. And we used to put a boom out, and they used to hook onto the boom, and we used to tow them while they got the crane latched onto the top of the wing. And one day we were picking up the aircraft, and all the wires had got tangled up, so the chief just looked at me and said, "Over the side and untangle those wires." And this was out in the Atlantic, you see, and it's an example of, I thought, well, I didn't resent it, because in a way I thought I was capable of doing it, they thought I was capable of doing it, so it was an effect, a compliment. But these things were always happening to me. I was not in the signal branch, but when we were going alongside in harbour, I usually had a station on the bridge. When we were going alongside, not in harbour, going alongside, had a station on the bridge, which was a signal job really, but it was the communications between the officer in charge of the handling parties aft, so that when the wires got, they kept a green flag flying all the time, the wires were clear of the screws, and the repeat was my flag, you see, for the captain to be able to see that any movements he made were not being hampered by the wires that were probably trailing in the water. And if the wires went anywhere near where the screws were, then the red flag was as simple as that. But just an indication that a signal job was given to a boy seaman. Another interesting thing was when we went out to the Far East, we had an admiral on board, and I was his runner, and I thought, oh good, it means I don't have to do watch keeping, see. But unfortunately, if we had the morning watch, the starboard crew, if we were in two watches, we had the morning watch and had the afternoon watch off, the remainder of the turret would go below and have the afternoon to themselves. But being the admiral's runner, I had to go below, get changed, report to the admiral's cabin, and then when we had the dog watches, I had to go forward and get changed into a boiler suit again and back to the turret. So they kept me pretty busy a lot of the time.
Did you go on the trip across the Atlantic with Churchill to the meeting with Roosevelt?
Yes, I appear in a number of photographs on the quarterdeck of the Prince of Wales.